my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Hit the rowdy road, many kinds I've met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick, the time out, there's so much left to know when I'm on.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. We are now streaming live on the Internet. Go to kkrn.org. Click on the Listen button. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourself. So go back to that website one more time, kkrn.org, and click on the donate button. Your donations help keep us on the air. The monthly donations are really appreciated, even if they're small amounts, because they're continuous. So thank you for supporting us, all of those out there that do. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. And we appreciate your calls because they kind of make the show that much more interesting and get you involved. And we can also get an idea of what you want to know from our guests or from whatever we're playing. So today's show, well, let me give you the phone number here, 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. Today's show is really going to feature a talk given by Chris Hedges at Santa Cruz in November. And Hedges, for those that don't know him, is a senior fellow at Nation Institute. He spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent, ending his Pulitzer Prize-winning career as a journalist after 15 years at the New York Times. He is the author of the bestsellers War is Force That Gives Us Meaning, American Fascists, Empire of Illusion, Death of the Liberal Class, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress, and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. He currently writes for numerous publications, including Harper's, the New York Review of Books, Granta, and Mother Jones. He has regular columns on truthdig.com also. He is... Well, he's many things, but he's almost prophetic too. But he's also an advocate and an activist in our democratic system. And in January of 2012, I played parts of another speech of his, Calling All Rebels, and you can look at that or listen to that, I should say, at kkrn.org/broadcasts/view/82, or you can go online to KKRN under shows/unspun, and you'll find a whole list of over 100 shows that we've done in the past 3 years. Hedges not only talks, but he walks. He talks a talk, but he walks a walk in challenging fascism and injustice wherever he finds it. For a couple of years, he's been a litigant challenging Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which was just signed once again into law by President Obama. And that allows the president and the Pentagon to abduct and disappear anyone, even Americans, anywhere in the world without due process. So, on November 23rd of this year, Hedges gave a talk in Santa Cruz. I was fortunate enough to be there and to get Chris Hedges' permission to rebroadcast his speech and use it any way I want. So what I've done here is I've excerpted several sections of his speech, and I've slightly edited some of them for the broadcast. I'll add comments and make calls as we go along or take calls as we go along. But now let's get started on Chris Hedges' speech. I call this speech Fighting Fascism. Here's Excerpt number one, History of Suppression in the USA.
Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act is part of the culmination of an assault on our civil liberties, a long assault, one which goes back a century, beginning in World War I. On the eve of World War I, we had powerful, progressive, radical movements, labor unions, a radical press, which, after decades of struggle, had finally begun to put pressure on the business elites, the oligarchic class, the centers of power. And it was the war that essentially created the mechanism by which this class could respond and fight back. The labor wars in this country were the bloodiest in the industrialized world. Hundreds of American workers were killed, thousands were injured, and tens of thousands, if not more, were blacklisted and displaced from their jobs. Wilson, who had run on the campaign slogan that he kept us out of the war, suddenly felt tremendous pressure from Wall Street, and Wall Street always profits off of war, to enter the conflict when the Russian Revolution meant that the Kaiser could transfer 51 divisions from the Eastern to the Western Front, and indeed, Germany made a final push that year and very narrowly defeated the British and the French. If the British and the French had been defeated, then the tremendous sums of money that Wall Street banks had lent to those governments would never be repaid. There was no popular support for this war. Indeed, when Wilson went to declare war in the White House, in the Congress from the White House, he had to be protected by an entire cavalry troop for fear of anarchist bombs. They could get no one to join. They had to institute the draft after 30 days. And there was a fascinating discussion among the intellectual elites, in particular Walter Lippmann, Arthur Boulard, and others, and I went to the archives in Princeton and read the papers, about how to respond to the fact that this country did not want to go to war. Wilson wanted to impose the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act as the kind of iron fist to make people comply, and Lippmann, Boulard, and others argued that they could employ the understanding of crowd psychology pioneered by Le Bon, Trotter, and Sigmund Freud to essentially manipulate emotion, or what Lippmann would call in his book Public Opinion, written after the war, manufacture consent. That's where Herman and Chomsky get that term on their critique of the medium. And they said, we can create mechanisms, a system of mass propaganda whereby people are moved to respond emotionally, that fact itself doesn't matter. And that system was set up, the Creel Commission, or the Committee for Public Information, which, by the way, Goebbels studied assiduously when he created the Nazi propaganda machine. Indeed, one of the textbooks that Goebbels uses was Edward Bernays' book, Propaganda. Bernays came out of the Creel Commission. Now, that was a seminal moment in American history. Randolph Bourne writes about it. He calls war, in which he writes that war is the health of the state. And what he means by that is that in wartime, the state has the power to accrue to itself all kinds of prerogatives that it would never be able to accrue to itself in peacetime. And that system of mass propaganda was a very effective form of manipulation. And Jane Addams and Bourne and others, Eugene V. Debs, write about quite depressing essays about how it wasn't just the masses that were seduced into the war effort. And you had Hollywood making movies like The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin. You had, they call them three-minute men, 50,000 speakers, 45,000 speakers that fanned out across the country. You had a news bureau that printed pro-war stories, and every publication in the country had to support the war, including Appeal to Reason, a socialist journal with the fourth highest circulation, the masses shut down rather than do it. So they were pumping out the pro-war news stories, graphic artists, and it not only seduced the masses, but it seduced the intellectual class itself. All of those people who, like Sinclair and others, who had put their energy into social reform, suddenly transferred their allegiance to this abstract cause, the war to end all wars, the war for democracy, which was a little hard to sell as long as the Tsar was in power. And only those who held fast, like Debs, like Adams, became targets. Debs, of course, eventually going to prison for opposing the draft. And that upended American society in a very deep way. The person who I think writes most presciently about it and is often not read and should be is Dwight MacDonald. MacDonald looks back at this moment in American history because at the end of the war, all of those propagandists went straight to Madison Avenue and started working on behalf of corporations. And they started, that's when you saw the installation or the upending of traditional American values of thrift, self-effacement, and replacing it with hedonism, the cult of the self, consumerism. And I think when we speak today about American values, what we're really speaking about are corporate instilled values.
You've tuned in to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. We're listening to segments of, well, we're going to listen to the whole speech in segments, but it's been edited and parts of it missing. I will have the full speech online where you can listen to the whole thing also along with the archives of this. But let's go to section number two, and you can call in 337-1885. We'll take your calls, but we have to squeeze any comments in between these segments to get all the way through the speech by the end of the show. So here's our second segment, History of Suppression in the USA, number two.
I bought every one of my students a copy of Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States. Now, that's a very important book because, and you know, my students are primarily African-American. They don't know their own history. And Zinn is very cognizant throughout that book of the African-American experience and the suffering of African-Americans. I think, like Baldwin, Zinn understood, and this is something that we have yet to grapple with as white Americans, understood that you cannot grasp what has been done to African-Americans in this country and internalize it in a real way and have an identity. Baldwin hits on this page after page after page. He said the grasping of what we have done to African Americans is not about fundamentally just the liberation of Africa. It's about our liberation. And until we understand who we are, we have no real identity. We have a mythic identity. And that's right. And Zinn got it. He got that. And I would be teaching the class, and I would hear my students go, damn, we've been lied to. But the brilliance of that book is that it deconstructs the myth of the founding fathers, which even the left in this country continues to deify. These were white, slaveholding, male oligarchs. And the last thing they wanted, and it's all in the Federalist Papers, the last thing they wanted was a popular democracy. And so they created innumerable mechanisms to make sure it wouldn't happen. And that was not only the disenfranchisement of African Americans, of women, of Native Americans, but also men without property. It was about creating a Senate where senators were appointed. It was about creating an electoral college. So that's how I have been a long supporter of Ralph Nader. I was his speechwriter in 2008. There's very few Americans I admire as much as Ralph Nader. And Ralph Nader did not lose the election of 2000 for George W. Bush. The election, first of all, was stolen by judicial fiat after they stopped the voting in two counties because they knew Gore had won. And I think that's very difficult for Americans to accept because it means we're just another banana republic. And Gore won 500,000 more of the popular vote. But because of the Electoral College, it didn't matter. It had nothing to do with Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader just scared the shit out of the Democratic Party. So the destruction of those movements, which Zinn grasps, had a fundamental effect on our democracy and finally on what's happening to us today, both economically and politically. And that was that it removed the counterweight. I mean, Zinn understood that all of the openings in American democracy came about by populist movements that never achieved power. The abolitionists, the suffragists, the labor movement, and finally the civil rights movement. And that's something the left has forgotten. It's not our job to take power. Karl Popper in The Open Society and Its Enemies writes that the question is not how do you get good people to rule. That's the wrong question. The question, because as Popper says, most people attracted to power are at best mediocre, which is Obama, or venal, which is Bush. I'm not sure he's even smart enough to be venal, but the question is how do you make the power elite frightened of you? That's what we forgot. That we have to build movements that hold fast to moral imperatives because power is always the problem. Julian Benda in The Treason of the Intellectuals writes, as an intellectual, you have a choice between serving two sets of principles, privilege and power, or justice and truth. Now, justice is not an afterthought for Benda, because Benda understood that you can't get to truth if you don't fight for justice. Because all systems of power, including the university, seek to obscure truth. And it is the role of those who fight passionately for justice to uncover and speak truth, finally speak truth to power. And Benda writes that the more you make concessions to those who serve privilege and power, the more you diminish the capacity for justice and truth. No functioning democratic society is going to exist unless there are powerful movements that hold fast to justice and truth.
Well, you've tuned in to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. Today we're featuring segments of a recent Chris Hedges speech that was given in Santa Cruz. I call the speech Fighting Fascism. Hedges tries to remind us of our real past, and part of the point of all of this, as he said, is to wake us up to our mythical identities, because we believe in things that aren't true. We're lied to and fed propaganda constantly now in America, and if you don't know the truth and you don't know how to find the truth, then how do you judge those things? So are you serving privilege and power, or are you serving truth and justice? Those are a couple of choices. If you make moral choices, some of us don't. Some of us are just apathetic and we go along. And I think that's what Chris Hedges is trying to do, is trying to wake us up because, quite frankly, there's nobody else going to fight for your rights and the truth or anything else. It's just down to the people and several corporations and a bunch of oligarchs and a corrupted governmental system. So you're going to have to make a choice eventually. The sooner you make it, the better. But let's just go on with Hedges' speech, and I'll stop ranting. Here's a segment I call Destruction of the Middle Class, Chris Hedges.
So the destruction of these popular movements had a catastrophic effect, because it removed the counterweight on the liberal class. And then we watched the destruction of the liberal class with the rise of Bill Clinton. Clinton continued to speak in that kind of feel your pain language of the liberal class while he assiduously collected corporate money and served corporate interests. So it's under Clinton we get NAFTA, the greatest betrayal of the working class in this country since the 1948 Taft-Hartley Act. It's under Clinton that we get the destruction of the welfare system. And remember that under our old welfare system, 70% of the recipients were children. It's under Clinton that we get the deregulation of the FCC. So we now have roughly a half dozen corporations, Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Disney, Clear Channel, that control about 90% of what most Americans watch or listen to. It's under Clinton that we get the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, which turns the prison industrial complex into a big corporate business, where the bodies of poor people, primarily of color, in what Malcolm X called our internal colonies, which in essence are surplus labor, because of course now we've been able to move our manufacturing first to Mexico and then finally on to China and Bangladesh, where they're making about 22 cents an hour. You take that surplus labor, it's not earning anything for corporate capital on the streets, so you put them in cages. And there, phone companies, private prison contractors, guards, they make $40,000 or $50,000 a year. And that's why we have a 60% recidivism rate, because that's the way it's designed. People say the system doesn't work. No, it works. It works just the way it's meant to work. We both teach in a prison, and it'll break your heart. It breaks your heart. I taught at Princeton. I've taught at Columbia. I've taught at NYU. I got students in that prison that'll bury any of those kids, bury them. Not just in terms of intelligence, but in terms of integrity. And you hear the stories of the people we put behind bars, and it will break your heart. I've got a student in there. He was 14 years old. He was in a gang. There was a knifing. He didn't do it. He was only 90 pounds. Everybody else in the gang was 19, 18. They haul him into the police station. They won't let him see his family. He's crying. It's 2 in the morning. He's got 2 detectives beating up on him, saying, just sign this paper, you go home. He signs the paper. At 14, he goes into the adult population. He's 39 now. He's one of my best students. He is not permitted to go before a parole board until he's 70. And if you try to go to court, they are going to hammer you and make an example of you so that no one else tries it, because 94% of everybody in this country who gets convicted of a crime pleads out. And if you don't plea out, they're going to make sure that what they do to you convinces everyone else to plea out. I have one student. He was on the U.S. Army boxing team for 5 years. He finished his Army service with an honorable discharge. He comes back to Elizabeth, New Jersey. He's training to go pro. He's picked up for a crime he did not commit. They offer him 16 months as a plea. He said, I didn't do it. And if I spend 16 months in a cell, my training's finished. It'd take me 2 years to come back. He goes to trial. He's got a 30-year sentence. Part of what's frightening about the moment we live in is that when you spend long enough in the prison system and you understand how it works, then you know exactly what they're going to do to us, because it's the same forces at work.
It's the same forces at work, Hedges tells us. And what does he mean? Well, he means it's the authoritarian police state that we're building around us, that we're allowing to be built around us. We have militarized police. They're driving, you know, bomb-resistant vehicles with turret-mounted machine guns on the top down our streets. Unheard of in America. wasn't allowed in America for most of our history. And then we're allowing now the president to bring the military into any area in the world, including in our country, and take anybody they want without due process, without a show of cause, without just bypassing the legal system altogether, if you can call what we have now a legal system. So you're listening to Unspun. Our phone number here is, if you want to call in, make a comment, or ask a question, phone number here, 337-1885, 337-1885. And we're featuring segments of a recent Chris Hedges speech. If you're just calling in, he talked on November 23rd in Santa Cruz to a full house of over 400 people that came to hear him talk. And I'm giving this speech the title, Fighting Fascism, Fighting Fascism. So this holiday season, when you're thinking about all the privileges you have as a fairly well-to-do white person sitting around, just remember there are entire families that are without their loved ones because they've been killed by our police state. We see this more and more. It's getting some attention in the news, as it should. And you need to pay attention because, quite literally, we're next. We're next in that police state. So let's go on to this next segment of the speech. This is one, Decline of the American Empire is what I call it. Here it is. Chris Hedges, Decline of the American Empire.
Now what happens? Our manufacturing goes overseas. We shift, in the words of the Harvard historian Charles Mayer, from what he calls an empire of production to an empire of consumption. We begin to borrow to maintain both a lifestyle and an imperium we can no longer afford. And at that point, you begin this steady economic and political decline. Coupled with the fact, although we've known it for 30 years, that the forces, the corporate forces that are degrading and destroying our ecosystem remain unchecked. And the economic crisis is intimately twinned with the environmental crisis. It's the same crisis. It's what Karl Marx understood, that unfettered, unregulated capitalism is a revolutionary force that commodifies everything, that turns human beings into commodities, the natural world into a commodity that it exploits until exhaustion or collapse. So that 40% of the summer Arctic sea ice melts and Shell Oil sees the death throes of our planet as a business opportunity. The death of labor unions, the loss of manufacturing, the absurdity that has become our press, which no longer does news. It's about ratings, it's about entertainment, it's about anything but news. The incredibly confining parameters of what is acceptable political debate. They just did a study on the recent upgrading or sending of more forces into Iraq of 89 pundits who were interviewed on the major networks. One was sort of against it. And the way that the insidious relationship, and General Electric is a defense contractor, and they own, you know, massive numbers of radios, of television stations. They hire ex-military who work for defense contractors to essentially call for an expansion of the wars in the Middle East, which makes them rich. I mean, war is a business. And that's why stocks of these defense corporations have increased 20-fold since 9/11. I was invited a few weeks ago to a white upper middle class church in New Jersey. Somebody got the cute idea that it would be a good idea to invite me for Peace and Justice Sunday. It was a bad idea. And they started walking out when I said, our militarized drones, our attack aircraft, our missiles, and our heavy artillery have decapitated far more people, including children, than ISIS. When you spend over a decade brutalizing people, they become brutal. And I quoted the example from a survivor of the Sobibor death camp, who when they got axes and knives and carried out the uprising, he talks about going into an office and confronting a German with a knife and going, "This is for my mother, this is for my father, this is for my sister, this is for my brother." The act itself, out of context, looks barbaric. But when you understand what went on in that death camp, it makes perfect sense. And the idea that the very violence that has created the pathology in front of us is the solution is, and I spent 7 years in the Middle East, is a failure completely to understand who we are and what we've done. Not only as white Americans in America, but as white Americans on the outer reaches of empire.
Well, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Today we are featuring segments of a recent Chris Hedges speech I call Fighting Fascism. Our call number is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. We invite your questions and your comments. Well, that last segment when Hedges pointed out the obvious that we've killed, decapitated, dismembered, and murdered far more people, innocent people, than ISIS has in Iraq. If that disturbed you, it's probably because you're holding on pretty tight to a belief that America is always doing the right thing, we have the right motives, we're doing the right thing. Well, the fact is we're doing the wrong thing, and we've been doing the wrong thing for about 14 years at least, or longer. We're a country of people that are predatory. We have no respect for the sovereignty of other nations, very little respect for other ethnic groups, other cultures. We're pretty self-centered and ignorant is what we are. Yeah, and if you'd like to discuss that with me, 337-1885, 337-1885. We're going to go on to this next segment of Chris Hedges' speech, which I entitled The Police State and the Imperial Blowback. And let me find that here. Here it is. Chris Hedges.
So you have the assault on the legal system, which is now very far advanced. Mass surveillance, the ability of the executive branch to serve as judge, jury, and executioner, the use of the Espionage Act to shut down whistleblowers, the end of investigative journalism. You can't be an investigative journalist if the person who's leaking you information can be instantly found out by the NSA. So that means there is, and I have friends at the Times, there is no more investigative journalism into the centers of power. None. You can't do it. And that's why Snowden fled the country. And coupled with that, you have the classic scenario of the end of empire. Thucydides writes that Athens became a tyrant abroad and then a tyrant at home. That the tyranny Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. I, who spent 2 decades on the outer reaches of empire and understand the cruelty and violence of empire, which is, despite the rhetoric, totally about overwhelming force and violence, have watched as the mechanisms of control on the outer reaches of empire have migrated back into the heart of empire. For a drug warrant in Oakland, you will have a militarized police force in Kevlar vests with long-barreled weapons with a command helicopter kicking down your door in the middle of the night and seizing you. There is no difference between a night raid in Oakland and a night raid in Fallujah. None. You have the creeping presence of drones adopted by local police forces. You have the infusion of military hardware, we've seen it in Ferguson, given over to police forces. You have total security and surveillance, which means that you can monitor any segment of the population you want. And most importantly, you have created what Hannah Arendt defines as a system of omnipotent policing. She writes about this in The Origins of Totalitarianism. And when she writes about this, she says, what happened in Europe, she herself had finished at the University of Heidelberg, and she writes, when she gets out of university, the Nazis are in power. And she said, I had to unlearn everything that I had been taught in school to become a moral being. She joins a Nazi resistance group. She's picked up by the Gestapo. She comes perilously close to being killed. She's expelled to France and stripped of her German citizenship. So she joins the numerous communities of stateless. We have them here. They're called undocumented workers, who have no rights within the society. She sees how the stateless become victimized by omnipotent police forces, this is the word she uses, that can do anything to them. And that, of course, has been the effect of the war on drugs. That you go into a community, a marginal community, and you can do anything. You can arrest people. People are arrested for, I forget the term, but it's called obstructing pedestrian traffic. It means standing on a sidewalk. I'm not making it up. You can be arrested for anything, riding your bike without a headlight, stacked with warrants. And Matt Taibbi just did a good book on this called Divide, where he compared the legal system for the rich, our oligarchs, and the legal system for the poor. And it's quite stunning. He's a great writer, great journalist. But those omnipotent police forces, Arendt writes, become insidious when a state loses its stability because you already have the corrosion of the legal system coupled with a physical mechanism by which to shut everything down. The lawyers and I thought one of the reasons that the power elites want to push through the NDAA is because in the end they don't trust the police to protect them. And I think that in the end that's why they want to be able to call out the military. You saw on the Chicago teacher strike, you had teachers would go into the bathrooms at the precincts and the police would applaud them. That terrifies the state. No act of resistance, even if it appears insignificant at the time, is ineffectual.
No act of resistance is ineffectual, but you have to get out there and resist to have some effect. You can't sit around the wood stove and listen to shows like this and think you've done your duty, because you haven't. And if you want to have some sort of semblance of what America is supposed to be, you're certainly going to have to get up and find something to get active in, whether it's global warming or anti-GMO or whatever it is that you believe in. And, of course, the big culprits in all of this are the huge corporate entities that are basically running the country, and that's who you're really going to be fighting against. And if we can win a few of those battles, then we have a chance. If we can't, then we don't, and our future is going to reflect that inability to recognize the threat and do something about it. Hedges is trying to point that out in so many different ways. The blowback from Empire. We know this is going to happen. It happened after the Vietnam War, where you had veterans returning. They go into the police force. Only these veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan and these other places basically trained to break down doors and either kill or take you away. There's no question about probable cause, and that's what we're headed for. So minorities are already suffering that. They've been suffering it for years, but we're next. So keep that in mind as you listen to Chris Hedges. This next section is a little bit more of a history of the National Defense Authorization Act and what that means for all of us and what has progressed for Hedges. Let me find this next little section. It's what I call History of Hedges versus Obama. Yeah.
Now, when empires go down, they all go down the same way. They expand, as the Roman Empire did, Gibbon writes about it, beyond their capacity to sustain themselves. They are hollowed out from the inside. And get in a car and drive across this country in city after city after city. It's a wreck. Our infrastructure is collapsing. We don't make anything except weapons. We, of course, 70% of the world's weapons, which we then spread out all over the globe like candy. And the power elites are certainly cognizant that none of the jobs, the unionized jobs that once permitted a single wage earner to sustain a family, buy a home, have health insurance and a pension, it's not coming back. They understand that that stagnation and decline, we have now half the country living in either poverty or near poverty, will eventually foster some kind of blowback. And we see blips on the screen. And so they're getting ready. And they get ready two ways. First, they corrupt the legal system to make criminality legal, which is essentially what Walls, what the lobbyists and this insane judicial system, which is now just a subsidiary of the corporate state, has done. They twist the legal system in such a way as to be able to carry out acts that under even the old Weimar Constitution would have been illegal. That's why everything that Richard Nixon was charged with on his impeachment is now legal. It is. Every single thing. And the state has done precisely that. It has radically interpreted, misinterpreted, even things like the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act, which Obama says gives him the right to assassinate American citizens. That's not in the act. It's a misuse of the act. The FISA Amendment Act, the wholesale surveillance, and, of course, Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act. And Judge Forrest ruled that the law was unconstitutional, and she wrote a very lucid 112-page opinion, which you should read, and I think she wrote it in a way that it would be accessible to those of us who don't come out of the legal profession. She talked about how this opens the way to criminalize an entire segment of the population. She actually brings up references to 110,000 Japanese Americans who were interned in World War II. And when she ruled in our favor, it wasn't just the government attorneys who had prosecuted the case who suddenly appeared in her chambers that day, but it was the lawyers from the NSA and the lawyers from the Pentagon. And they said, you have to put the law back into effect right now in the name of national security. And to her credit, she did not. And the government lawyers then went to the Second Circuit Court of New York and at 9 a.m. on Monday morning and demanded the same thing. And the Second Circuit, unfortunately, conceded. Now, why? I mean, the lawyers and I, Carl Mayer and Bruce Efron, we knew they'd appeal, but why? Why did they act so aggressively? And the only thing that we could surmise is because they're already using the law. Because there are already dual nationals, Pakistani, U.S., whatever, being held in black sites. And if that temporary injunction was allowed to stand, and those people could get out and get access to a court, the government could be held in contempt of court. So the Obama administration appealed it. And let's be clear, by the way, that Obama's assault on civil liberties has been far more egregious than Bush, including the misuse of the Espionage Act to shut down whistleblowers, the failure to curb wholesale surveillance. I mean, we are now the most monitored, watched, eavesdropped, photographed population in human history. And all of our information is stored in perpetuity in government computers. You can't use the word liberty when your government watches you 24 hours a day. That's the relationship of a master and a slave. So the Second Circuit gets it, and they got a problem, because stripping an American citizen of their right to due process and using the military is unconstitutional. That is kind of a problem for a court that doesn't want to rule it unconstitutional. So you go before the hearing. It's not a trial. You get a panel of three judges or four judges. I can't remember. We review the case. And for months, they don't rule. And the reason they don't rule is because I was also a plaintiff in Clapper versus Amnesty International. Now, this case was brought over the FISA Amendment Act of the wholesale surveillance, reached the Supreme Court. And we charged that the government was carrying out wholesale surveillance and was impeding our work as journalists. The government lawyers got up in the Supreme Court and said, well, this is complete speculation on the part of the plaintiffs. Not only that, if the government was carrying out surveillance, we would tell them. And so the Supreme Court threw it out, believing the government attorneys. And what the Second Circuit did is they waited for that ruling, and then they said, well, Hedges doesn't have standing, credibility to bring the case in Clapper versus Amnesty. I guess he doesn't have standing in this, and they threw it out. So they never had to rule on the issue itself. And that's how they have been effective at essentially, especially since 9/11, abrogating their role in terms of the defense of constitutional rights. We filed a cert petition to the Supreme Court. They didn't take it. And now it's up to you. And it is up to you. And that's not hyperbolic.
Well, Chris, Hedges did all he could do in court. Our corrupt corporate Supreme Court wouldn't even hear the case, and our government lied to the court, and that was acceptable. So that's where we're at with our legal system. I'm going to keep playing the speech because we're going to run out of time here. Here's the section I called Living in Truth, and Chris Hedges.
In The Power of the Powerless, it's called Living in Truth. And the capacity to stand up and live in truth, which is what you have the possibility to do as a community, and speak back to these forces that are essentially attempting to subjugate us. That living in truth ripples outwards in ways that you cannot begin to imagine. My friend Daniel Berrigan, Father Daniel Berrigan, says that the essence of faith is that the good draws to it the good. We don't know where the good goes. Faith is the belief that it goes somewhere. The Buddhists call it karma. But that faith is real. That capacity to stand up and bear witness is real. We cannot judge our lives by what is empirically done before us. It may be that by the end of our lives, everything we have fought for is worse. But that doesn't matter. That doesn't invalidate what we've done. Because we are able, when we stand up as a moral witness, to create a power that goes beyond our own lives. And my father is the example. A Presbyterian minister, involved in the civil rights movement. I grew up in a small farm town in upstate New York where Martin Luther King at the time was one of the most hated men in America. I watched people walk out of his church. He'd been a sergeant in North Africa in World War II, came back a pacifist. He told me when I was 12 or 13 that if the Vietnam War was still being waged when I was 18 and I had to go to jail, he would go to jail with me. I still have this vision of sitting for 2 years in a jail cell with my dad. His youngest brother, my uncle, was gay and lived with his partner in Greenwich Village and had been disowned by the rest of my father's family, and my father brought him into our family. And this was the 1970s. My father understood that the pain of being a gay man in America, which he saw through his brother who he loved, was being visited on many, many people throughout the country. And he stood up in the Presbyterian Church and called for equal gender equality rights for all people, regardless of their sexual orientation. Which led, not surprisingly, to the Presbyterian Church telling him to be quiet. And so my father's response was to open the doors of his church and hold a citywide Easter service for the GBLT community of the city of Syracuse. And I was at Colgate University at the time, which was an hour away as an undergraduate. And my dad was a great preacher, 40 years, came down and picked me up. And he said, I'm taking you to this service because it's the last time you're ever going to hear me preach. And he got up. That church was packed. And even before it started, people were weeping because the church had delivered such cruelty to them. And my dad got up and said, marriage is a sacrament. It is not a reward for being a heterosexual. And any church that does not honor the sacrament of marriage does not deserve to call itself Christian.
You're listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling, and we're listening to segments of Chris Hedges' recent speech in Santa Cruz. We don't have enough time here to have any comments or take any phone calls, so I'm just going to go ahead and play this last segment of Chris Hedges' speech, which I call Fighting Fascism. Here it is, Chris Hedges.
Years later, I'm in the New York Times office. I had been the Middle East Bureau Chief for the New York Times 7 years in the region. Bush was calling for the invasion of Iraq. I understood, like all Arabists, that we were not going to be greeted as liberators. Democracy was not going to emanate outwards from Baghdad across the Middle East. The oil reconstruction was not going to pay for rebuilding Iraq. I gave a commencement address at Rockford College, where I was booed off the stage for denouncing the war. 1,000 people in the audience actually stood in the middle of my address and began singing God Bless America. They cut my microphone twice. It's also on YouTube. They, after 18 minutes, I had two burly senior guys in robes try and climb up and push me off the podium. Campus security is freaking out. The president comes over and tells me to wrap it up. Campus security, before the awarding of diplomas, was the last time I've ever been invited to give a commencement address. Before the awarding of diplomas, wants to hustle me off the stage. I'm in a robe. I say, look, my jacket, it's in the president's office. They said, we'll mail you your jacket. They drive me to a hotel room, watch me pack my bags, put me on a bus to Chicago. Well, of course, Fox, the right wing, they get the video clips, the audio, and just like my friend Jeremiah Wright, I get lynched hour after hour after hour. And I get called into the New York Times for a reprimand, a written reprimand, because under guild or union rules, you give the employee the written reprimand, and the next time they violate that reprimand, they're fired. And I sat in that office, and I didn't want to lose my job, and I realized that I could muzzle myself and pay fealty to my career, but to do so would be to betray my dad. And I quit. And when I walked out that door, I realized for the first time that what my father had given me was freedom. I didn't need the New York Times to tell me who I was. I knew who I was. And that's your role for us, for the rest of the country. I did everything I could through the courts, and I failed. But the fight's not over. It's in your hands. Stand up. Say no. And there are communities across this country who will say no with you. And even if we fail, it doesn't matter. I don't fight fascists because I'm going to win. I fight fascists because they're fascists. Thank you.
Chris Hedges before a sold-out crowd in Santa Cruz last month. I just want to read a quote from one of his books, Empire of Illusion. A culture that does not grasp the vital interplay between morality and power, which mistakes management techniques for wisdom and fails to understand that the measure of a civilization is its compassion, not its speed or ability to consume, is condemned itself to death. That's where we are in America. And that'll be the end of my comment. We only have a couple minutes, and I want to remind you, you've been listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Today's broadcast is an edited version of a speech given by Chris Hedges, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and advocate for democracy and freedom. The speech was given at the Inner Lights Ministries in Santa Cruz, California, November 23rd, 2014. I have to thank Chris Hedges for his moral leadership and generosity in sharing his work with us. More of his articles are linked, and links to books and interviews can be found on truthdig.com. The audio of the entire speech will be available along with the archives of this show at kkrn.org/shows/unspun. Tune in every Saturday morning, 9 a.m., for your weekly dose of the truth. And thanks for listening. Next up on KKRN is Peace Talks Radio.